Welcome to Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. Joyous conversations about what the afterlife evidence and modern science combine to tell us is true about our one reality. You have nothing to fear. You are eternal and you are perfectly loved. Knowing the truth changes everything. Now, here's Roberta.
Hello, everyone. This is Roberta Grimes, and of course, this is Seek Reality, and you and I are about to spend a little more time together learning more about what really is true. It's time for us to know what's true, and we're going to, frankly, I think we've already mostly figured it out, but we just enjoy sharing it with one another. We're told that the fact that we're now getting much better evidence of what actually is going on really is not even an accident. Not only are we being given, of course, better methods of communicating with those that we used to think were dead, but we're also getting such amazing phenomena as near-death experiences, which, by the way, were only even named in 1975. Although we think they have been occurring, and there is some evidence that they have been occurring, they've been very, very rare until recently. Those that who have completed their deaths tell us death is always a one-way trip, but still, many NDEs are extraordinary adventures in the enormous astral, and they help us to know for certain that all the greater reality that exists beyond this rough, tough physical universe is based in and filled with love and light. And all these different kinds of experiences can be amazingly transformational. I think that by the time we've passed midlife, for probably close to half of us, there's been some experience like this that you just can't explain, that has been ineffable and has made a tremendous difference in our lives. Now, there's one kind of experience we've never really talked about here, and it's an important phenomenon. It's called the shared death experience, or SDE. Today, our guest is Dr. Sharon Prentice. She had a shared death experience when her husband died that altogether transformed her life. And she tells her very personal, beautiful story in a lovely book called Becoming Starlight, A Shared Death Journey from Darkness to Light. Now, Dr. Prentice turns out to be a big shot. She's a licensed clinical pastoral counselor, board-certified spiritual counselor, board-certified in cognitive behavioral therapy, group therapy, integrative marriage, oh my goodness, family therapy, crisis and abuse therapy. She's a member of the American Counselors Association and a whole raft of other associations for people who use their lives to help others. She's a commissioned minister of pastoral care. Wow. I don't know how you even keep up with all that, Sharon. Welcome.
I don't even think about all of that stuff. It's just, you know, that kind of stuff is just the stuff that gets you in the door. You know, you gotta have all of those things. And I don't even, my people call me Sharon. When someone says Dr. Prentice, I turn around to see who they're talking about.
That's right. But now, does each of them have a certificate that you hang on your wall?
Oh, no. I did in the beginning, you know, when you get real impressed with yourself and you go, yeah, I got it, you know, and now I hang up the ones that people will say, okay, she knows a little bit of what she's doing, and the others are in a drawer somewhere, seriously. I just keep the main ones up on the wall, so when somebody, you know how when you go to see somebody new, you look on the wall to see, you know.
I think I have two. A wall like that, actually, when I was working as an attorney and helping business owners, because it did impress them. But it never really impressed me. They're all in a box at this point. But
so you know what I'm talking about. You know exactly what I'm talking about. You know, gets you in the door. That's it.
I have to say, I think you're an amazing writer. I see a lot of books, many first books, and I really can't remember ever reading a first book that had the ease with words, the emotional pitch that your book does. In fact, I was sure you must be a novelist. I went to Amazon, actually, to see if you had any other books there, but this is the only one.
Yep, this is it. And, you know, it was such a labor of love for me, and it just, once I started it, it just kind of flew out. You know, it was one of those things that just, and Wayne Dyer, I know you know who Wayne Dyer is. He was a good friend of mine, and he actually talked me into finally writing this. And I said to him, I'm used to charts and things like that. What do I know about writing a book? And he said, tell the story, Sharon. Tell the story.
That's all you have to do. That's right.
All I just tell the story. And, you know, I have told the story to so many people over the years. You know, a great majority of my patient profile are terminally ill patients and their families. And, you know, palliative care, I'm one of the ones called in, you know, after they get the diagnosis that, you know, that just sets somebody back on their heels. And I'm the one that's called in to sit and talk with them. And it always, always comes up the question, should I be afraid? And that's when I sit down and I say, let me tell you a story.
Yes.
And well, see, that's what I've used this for.
We're going to talk about that story. In fact, it's sort of archetypical. It's the kind of spiritual transformation story that many people live, but we never get to hear their stories. And Sharon's mm-hmm. is well told. We're going to ask her to tell some of the highlights of ours. But first, I want to look at what a shared death experience is. This is another term coined by Raymond Moody in his Glimpses
yep.
of Eternity, which I love. And
oh, yeah.
Let's talk about what it is. Essentially, a shared death experience is something that happens if you're sitting at the bedside, usually of a very, very close loved one, and you have an experience at the same time that they are going through their transition. Often it's an extraordinary experience. By the way, everyone read Glimpses of Eternity, because that anything that frankly that he writes with his sidekick Paul Perry is a very, very good book, and it's short and
yeah.
it's easy to read. But so everyone read that. But let's talk about the elements of an SDE. That there are two lists that Sharon gives in her book, which I think are helpful. Dr. Moody says these people see a light. Now, between you and me, it seems to me they don't always see a light, but that's apparently often the case. They see deceased relatives of the dying who come to meet them. We now believe that's a universal thing that happens when you die. You have people mm-hmm. that you love and trust come to meet you. They see the spirits of the dying rising up from the body, and it's usually called a misty glow or a grayish cloud. That is absolutely typical. In fact, I think if your vibration is high enough, you probably always would see that if you were watching a death. And they
right.
sometimes participate in the panoramic life review of the dying person so that they get to have the whole experience the dying person has happened, maybe having. Maybe the person's whole life will flash by. And they feel this is the thing I don't get, Sharon. They feel the dimensions of the room around them transforming from a square or rectangle to an hourglass shape. What is that
you know,
all about?
Oh, people experience the room changes in different ways. I have heard people say the hourglass, and I've heard people say that it just got, you know, bigger and bigger and bigger till it wasn't there anymore. For me, the ceiling just disappeared, and the floor disappeared, and the walls just kind of, the stars just came in and got me, because the wall, everything just turned to mist. I knew I was standing on a floor, but the floor wasn't there. And I knew
yes.
there was a ceiling above me, but the ceiling wasn't there. So it all depends on whatever, you know, each individual person is actually experiencing.
Now there's a website called shareddeathstudy.org where people
mm-hmm.
can post these experiences, and they give a slightly different list of what the elements are of a typical shared death experience. And I think these are pretty varied. So, you know, typical is we have to stretch that quite a bit. Again, they talk about the room shape changes. And that's something which, when we talk about, I'll have to talk about an actual death again at some point pretty quickly, because we haven't talked about that in a while, but that's typical if you are actually the person dying. The room mm-hmm. shape changes, the bystanders see that mist rising from the dying person's body, and the dying person telepathically communicates with these bystanders. The person who is dying leaves their body and is engulfed by an intensely bright light that feels like absolute love. Again, we have sometimes a life review with the dying person. The dying person accompanies the bystander who has been in part of this accompanies the dying person to heaven, but not quite, because, of course, it's a one-way trip. So usually
right.
people who go, you know, get pretty close are told they've got to go back, and I think that happened to you.
Yeah.
Often the person who is having this experience with the person who is transitioning is aware of the deceased relatives and friends and who are there in the room. So as you can see, this is a well-documented experience, but most people are really not even aware of it. I don't know. Have you any sense of how common these are?
They are more common than you think. People just haven't talked about them.
Yes.
There really wasn't a name for what it was. I mean, when it happened to me, that's how I met Raymond, as a matter of fact, Dr. Moody. As a matter of fact, I needed somebody to explain to me. I knew what I experienced was real, but I needed to know what it was, you know. And he was the one that explained it to me. And since that time, more and more people are coming out and telling their particular experiences with this. And like you said in the beginning, you said something in the beginning of this that really hit home with me. I honestly believe that every single person has had some type of an experience. It's just a matter of degree, you know, and whether they want to accept the fact that, hey, you know, this is something that I really, you know, can't explain. Everybody has a story of some kind. Don't you find that?
I think that's true, but the problem is that, I mean, I had two experiences of light, which are rare and pretty extraordinary. The first one I had at 8, mm-hmm. the second at 20. The first time I ever told anybody what had happened to me, I was, I think, 43. So clearly, this is, I think, an instinct not to share it for a few reasons.
Oh, it is.
Number one, it's personal.
Yes.
You know what happened, but you don't want anybody to tell you that, oh, you're being silly, and you know they will.
Exactly.
You don't want anyone to poison this beautiful experience.
Yeah.
And I think
and oftentimes there aren't words for it. Our language does not have the words.
There are some of these experiences. I think it's important for everyone to understand, and this is another thing we'll be talking about here before too long. Nearly all of what we think of as reality is what we think of as the astral. It's many times the size of the universe. Scientists say that they think that the material universe is less than 5% of what they know exists. And, of course, they don't know everything that exists because this is one of many universes. So that astral is extremely important, and there's a lot in it. One of the things in it is the discrete area where our dead are. But that's not all that's there. That's only a tiny, really tiny part of it, relatively. So in all that enormous astral, the only thing that really exists, it's sort of the way we now see sunlight, is love. And it's the love of God. It's incredible how much love, and that's why these experiences really are so transformational, because to go from this rough, awful place and spend a moment in that atmosphere, for anybody who has it happen, it's beyond our ability, as you say, even to describe it.
Right.
What I want to do is talk about your story. Now,
sure.
You started it. You were talking about, you know, love children and bell bottoms and all of that and the war. So I have to believe you're like around my age, because I was young in the 60s too. Was it
right,
the 60s
yes.
when you met Steve?
It was. I met him in 1969.
All right. So we're talking about our generation here.
Yes.
and all right. So you met him. And I have to just say, the first part of your book is really quite lovely. This love story, you immediately, you didn't really want to, because you were an Army kid. You didn't want to have an Army husband, but I guess he was Navy, right?
He was Navy, yeah.
You did not want to do that again, but this man was so overwhelmingly wonderful that you did it. You did it.
Yep. He was, once we locked eyes, or I should say he locked eyes on me and he wouldn't let go. And, you know, whenever you feel intimidated or flustered, and I never was that way, but he made me feel that way. I wanted to avert my eyes constantly, but every time I would look at him, those eyes were locked on me, and he had that smirk on his face, you know, and you just can't get away from things like that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, another thing we know, of course, is that we plan our lifetimes. And one of the things we plan is the person that we are going to marry. And sometimes there's, of course, more than one, because we're going to do that. And
right.
So there an effort is really made by our guides and by as you say, the universe, to keep us, to put us together and to make us want to, you know, become a couple. In my case, believe it or not, Sharon, I walked into a room. It was a mixer. I walked into a room, And there were all these people in the room, and it was kind of darkish. And there was one man sitting there, and he was surrounded, I kid you not, by a halo of light.
Oh, my gosh.
I thought, okay, I better go talk to that guy. And I did. And we talked all night, and we've been married for 46 years. So,
well, there you go.
Yes. They said it wouldn't last. Sometimes I wonder if it still, you know, might not last. But so far, so good, I think.
There you go. That's right. You just kind of knew, didn't you? You just knew. Yeah, it's amazing. You know, when someone says, how did you find each other? It was just, I know it sounds so silly to say, oh, well, it was meant to be. But there are some things in this life that are just meant to be. And no matter where you are in the universe, it's going to happen.
Yes, we plan it into our lives. So everyone listening, if you have that feeling about someone when you see, of course, I think I've never seen anyone else who saw a halo of light. No one else seems to have had that experience. But they wanted to make sure I think they think I'm especially thick. My guides do. They wanted to make sure I didn't miss this. But listen to your feelings, because if you have a feeling that someone is this special, as Sharon did, as I did, respond to those feelings, because they're coming from your guides. And if you don't get together the first time, they'll arrange to have you keep circling around and meeting one another. I mean, you did plan this, so if it's right, it will happen. So you met him and you fell in love. And it was lovely in the beginning. I mean, a little bit haphazard, but lovely, a beautiful love story. Then you became pregnant with Stephanie. Now, what I didn't understand was, why was she born too soon? Because obviously you were having problems, but I never understood why.
That pregnancy was so unbelievably difficult, almost from the first day. I was sick. I couldn't eat. I lost down to like 90 pounds, and I'm 5'7". I couldn't eat. I couldn't drink. I was hospitalized over and over and over again. I kept going into premature labor where they would put me in the hospital. I mean, this started at about when I was 3 months pregnant. And, I mean, the being hospitalized. It
premature
was
labor?
Constant.
Oh, my goodness.
It was constant, constant, constant. And I actually didn't mind being put in the hospital all those times, because for some reason I felt safe, you know, like someone was watching over me, with all the nurses and everybody.
Did they give you a reason why you were having all these problems?
No, nobody ever gave me anything. And that was extremely frustrating and fearful. And, you know, it was just a very, very horrible time. And that's when I got into, you know, counting the weeks, counting the days, counting the hours, you know, to where I knew that she would be safe. But then that last day came, and you know yourself, back then, you know, early 70s, they didn't have all of the, you know, prenatal neonatal things that they have now. And it was just, that was one of the single, that was the single most tragic event
life. Where was it? Was she in her gestation? Because they didn't even attempt that. They just put this dying baby into your arms. Was it possible for her to survive?
No, they told me it wasn't. And, you know, every once in a while now, when I'm in the hospitals or I meet people who have had babies that were more, you know, preemie than Stephanie was, and these little guys live, it still takes me back, and it just kills my soul. I was just a little bit over 6 months. And they are actually saving babies now.
Oh, they're saving babies then. Right,
yeah,
at that age.
I know. Totally. But, yeah, and it was just the most tragic, tragic thing. I realized what was happening, but I didn't realize what was happening. You know what I'm saying?
Of course.
I didn't want to accept anything that was going on at that time. And that event, I believe, was the precursor to my having the SDE when my husband died.
But it was a painful thing to read this part of your book, because I really got to feel how you were feeling and how despairing you was at your baby's loss, which I mean, I couldn't believe that the baby was still alive, and they put the baby into your arms. They didn't try to save it. That part bothered me. In fact,
it bothers me then, and it still bothers me now. That's one thing I don't think I will ever forget. I was at a naval hospital. It was out at the Great Lakes Naval Station in Waukegan in Illinois. And I remember it, even right now, I remember every single thing that was said in that room, everything that was done in that room. I mean, I may forget what happened this morning, but I remember those things. You know, they are imprinted on my soul. It bothers me to this day, and I know it will till the day I die.
But all right, so this was one bad experience with military medical care. Then your husband, whom you clearly adore, he began to lose weight and not do well, and no one could, and they put him through test after test, and no one could tell you what was wrong. But it turned out he was being poisoned by something at work. Explain that, please.
Steve was one of the designers of the electronic warfare that is on all our battleships. And he was so enthralled with what he was doing. You know, he and his teammates would go into these little closeted rooms. You know, he was on one of those bases where you weren't even supposed to know they were there. They had barbed wire around the top of the fences.
Oh, my
goodness. I couldn't even go in.
Oh, my.
Yeah. It was out in the middle of the Ocala Forest in Florida. And that's where he started. And he would be in there for days and days. I never knew when he was going to come home. And his body was bombarded by stuff that no human body should have ever been bombarded by.
And it never occurred to these people that maybe that was a problem?
I brought it up. We brought it up. We brought it up all the time because that's when he started getting sick, and they would do the tests and stuff they had at the time, and they'd say, oh, nothing, or they'd give him something as silly as Gelucil, which was an old Maalox at the time, saying, oh, it's just your stomach. Oh, yeah. All these types of things, and he just kept getting sicker and sicker and sicker and sicker. And he did have one surgery after another. They told him he had an ulcer, so they went in and took out part of his stomach, saying that you're going to be fine, you know, everything's going to be good now. And I'll never forget, at the Portsmouth Military Hospital, the naval base there in Norfolk, when he had that surgery there where they took out part of his stomach, as an aside, the doctor, after telling me, oh, he's going to be fine, you know, he's going to need some rest or whatever, but when he's done, he's going to be fine. And then as he was leaving the room, he said, oh, we noticed that his pancreas was a little swollen, but I think it's going to be fine now once, you know, we got rid of what was going
Lord.
On in his belly. Yeah, and that all came back to slap me in the face.
Of course. And do you think that all the medical care being given to, because this was the Vietnam era, and
yes.
there were a lot of young people who were getting mm-hmm. medical care and it in wartime because they were fighting for their country. However we feel
right.
now about that war, they were fighting for their country. Were they all getting such awful care?
You know, to this day, honestly, to this very day, when I hear someone say they're going to go into the VA, I get just chill bumps all over
Lord.
My body.
Oh,
and then every time I see something on television about the bad care that they get at the Veterans Administration, the same thing happens to me because this has been going on for decades. When you hear about it on television about the, you know, the bad care that our veterans get, it is absolutely true. And I don't care what president is in there. They all say, oh, we're going to give our vets the best service there is and the best medical care, and no one has done it yet. And it's absolutely infuriating to me that in this day and age, this is still going on.
Well, I have to say, because you're such a good writer, it was very painful to watch Steve decline. And to also be wondering what could possibly be wrong with him. He was such a healthy, vibrant man, and he was going to go off and do some fancy stuff behind the lines and so on. And then they just sent him home because he was not strong enough to even do the training. Which I mean, it's as if human life was not important to them. What else could we possibly imagine?
I know, and that was my problem. You know, people have asked me, you know, who is the antagonist, you know, in my life, and it's a horrible thing for me to say, but it was the medical system. It let us down all the way around. It was just, I like I said, I still think of it now, and it's ridiculous. You know, when he was in SEER training, I was terrified for him.
Yeah, I have to just say that's a fancy training to go behind the lines where nobody knows you. And I mean, just to read what he was going to be asked to do, and this is in Vietnam, which was a very nasty place at that time. So,
SEER stands for Survival, Evasion, Resistance, Escape. Because you're going into a place where people are intent on capturing you and killing you.
You have to have the
skills. It's rough. And I was very, very afraid for him because I could see what was happening to him, and I was hoping that someone else was going to see it. And, you know, that day that he came home after the last 2 weeks, they said, you know, go report over to Coronado to get a physical because there was no way he was going to go. And he was going to be a military advisor behind the lines there in Vietnam. And there was no way on earth that he could survive, especially if he had been captured, which a lot of the military advisors were. There was no way he could survive it. And so we went, he got checked out, and they're like, oh, yeah, well, you know, you're just having a hard time, and sent him on his way.
That's very upsetting. For people who are younger than we are, the Vietnam War period was an interesting period because, for me, it was a transformative period. Every night, everybody would watch the TV news, night after night after night. All you would see would be, you know, helicopter wash in the grass, the helicopter lands, the dying boys get put into the helicopter, it takes off again. That was every single night. We got to
every night.
We were on the front line of that war. We, young people in that, and no wonder people marched in the streets because they weren't fighting for anything important. I mean, they were losing their lives and they were being drafted to do it. Oh, I can tell I'm still upset after all these years. They were
I agree.
If they weren't lucky enough to have a high number or whatever, high number was what you needed, or to be able to go to school, you know, you were marched. My own husband was sent to Vietnam. I mean, he was sent as a physician, so he actually had a good time, but that's another story. But
my dad had two tours there. My father was there for two tours. He was an intelligence officer over there. And that was one of the reasons, too, that I didn't want to be military because my dad was World War II, Korea, Vietnam. You know, he was in all of them. And I remember, I mean, I was, you know, a teeny baby, but I remember the stories that he would tell and how much it affected him. And then, of course, when he was in Vietnam, I was in high school. And when he came back, you know, PTSD, which they had no name for back then. The things that he went through, he suffered till the day he died with jungle rot on his feet and his toes. The kids nowadays have no idea
about that. I have no idea. When you see these old guys who are Vietnam veterans and fought in Vietnam, they deserve your respect because that was ghastly war, and they were sent there against their will because there was a draft, and they accomplished nothing because there was nothing to accomplish. The government was just sending them there because they were cannon fodder. Terrible time.
Terrible time. And that's one of the reasons that I didn't want a military husband or boyfriend. So when Steve walked into that bar, we were at the place called the King's Head Inn, which was the college hangout. That's where everyone went when they skipped classes, okay? Nobody wanted to go to classes. We would all meet at the King's Head Inn, everybody. And he and two of his friends came in full dress uniform, and the whole place just stopped and looked at them like, who are you? Why are you here? Because military did not come in there. You know, that wasn't a place that they went. You remember the times. You remember what it was like.
Oh, yes. Everyone was hostile to the people in uniform, which you know, wasn't their fault in many cases. They were drafted.
That's right.
But what I want to do now is talk about – I'd like you to have you tell the story about Steve's death. I'll lead us up to it. You know, there we were. Her husband ended up with pancreatic cancer because – of all this stuff he had been handling, and nobody ever diagnosed it until it was too late. He had pancreatic cancer. You may as well write your will. Even today,
absolutely,
it's a very, very tough cancer to beat. And so you did a beautiful job. You stayed with him through it all. And it was actually painful, but it was beautiful to read also, coming up to his death. And then he wasn't breathing anymore. And take us from there.
That last day was really just no word for it. But it started early in the morning.
Get us to the good part. Or not.
Okay.
Well, I mean, it is the good part. But
no,
but
I know what you mean. Okay, what had happened was
that experience, that shared death experience, which really you told so beautifully in the book.
Okay. I guess to back it up, just for 20 seconds here, his tumors had broken up during the day and traveled to his brain,
and he
couldn't see, he couldn't hear, he couldn't move, he couldn't anything. So I crawled up into bed with him and stayed that way all day. And the only time I left his side was that evening when the oncologist who was in the room with us said, I need to check some things. So I decided to get up and run to the bathroom. When I went to the bathroom, I heard the oncologist just yell out. I won't say what he said because it's kind of profane, and I don't know you'd appreciate the words. And
yeah, right.
So
this is a fail.
You get the idea.
Yes.
Because what had happened was Steve had actually rolled over and opened his eyes, which was a medical impossibility.
Yeah.
And when I heard the doctor yell, I raced out of the bathroom, almost falling flat on my butt, and raced over to the side of the bed so that I could see him. And I knelt down, and we were nose to nose and forehead to forehead. I was so close to him that it was blurry, you know, seeing him. You know when you get real close to something, you kind of lose focus?
Yes.
And I looked at him, and I saw that he was looking at me. I knew he could see me. And of all the things to say, I just said, I said, what are you staring at? I mean, how stupid is that? But, you know, you think you'd say something so profound. And I said, what are you staring at? And he spoke back, and he said, I just want to remember. Everyone in the room just gasped when that happened, including me. And you know when you gasp, you suck in your breath, right?
Yes.
Well, I did that. It was this big, you know, one of those, because I was so shocked and so happy because I thought we had our reprieve. And he breathed out at the same time I breathed in, and I could feel his breath. It was warm, you know, just kind of going down into my lungs. I could feel it, and my eyes were closed because I was really just rejoicing. You know, I had won this battle with God, okay? I beat him in his own game. I wasn't going to let him take anyone else.
Yes.
Yeah, and then I opened my eyes, and I saw that his eyes had gone dark, and he had died. And I fell to the ground when I realized that he was gone, and this noise, this guttural thing that came out of me was, I mean, it wasn't a word, but it was just this noise. And then that's when things started to change. I was on the floor. I wasn't laid flat. I was like on my knees, but the rest of my body was bent down, you know, over my knees. And I couldn't really even move. And it was at that point that I know you've heard of just letting go. Okay, everyone has heard of letting go, just emptying yourself to whatever, you know, is out there. And at that point, there was absolutely nothing left of me. I had nothing to give to anybody, not even myself. And what I call the egoic mind, you know, the ego that tells you who, what, where, when, why, you know, all that stuff of your life, that was gone. There was absolutely nothing left. And that's when the floor started to change. I stood up. Somehow I stood up. I always have said that I felt like someone lifted me up because I knew I could. I did not have the strength to lift myself up, but there I was standing up, and the ceiling started to disappear. It just turned into this misty nothingness, and the floor, the same thing happened to the floor. And I knew that I was standing on the floor, but the floor wasn't there anymore. And that's when I noticed the stars. You know, the book is entitled Becoming Starlight, and that was the only title it could ever have. Even when people tried to change my mind, when publishers tried to change my mind, I said no, because that's what happened. The stars just came and got me, and it just seemed like there were billions and billions of them. I could see each one separate and distinct, and yet it was just one great, big, huge light. It was like a fibrous netting, okay? It was like this, like our nervous system, this fibrous netting that I became a part of. And I have said many times, I don't know whether I became a part of it or it became a part of me or where I began and where it ended or vice versa, but I went into that so freely, Roberta, because there was a presence, okay, among those stars. I felt this presence that I never really felt it before, and yet I knew it. I felt like I was home. This was someplace I had, but it was a very long ago. I've called it a long ago forgotten memory, but it felt like home. And so I just went willingly right into it because there was nothing left of me, nothing at all. But what I felt, that's where I was. Okay, that's where I was supposed to be. That was my place in the universe. And so I went very, very freely. And my eyes were, I can't say I was physically there, but I was there. I was just a better me than I had ever been before. And I saw him. He was standing right in front of me. He looked exactly the way he had looked when he was well. Yes. And he was smiling at me. He had the most amazing, beautiful smile on his face. And I just looked at him and once again said the most profound thing I've ever said before. I said, I can see you, you know, I mean, please. You think you'd come up with something that was,
yes,
you know, going to just rock you off your feet, but that's all I said. But he didn't speak. We didn't touch. We didn't need to. It was exactly the way it was supposed to be, and I knew that. I didn't ask why. It didn't matter. I didn't ask why all of these things had happened in my life, why I had to lose my daughter, why I was losing him. None of that stuff mattered. I was being held within this netting, within this presence that I felt cocooned. And to say, you know, a lot of people will use the words unconditional love. Yeah, I don't ever say unconditional love because when I hear other people say it, it kind of makes me smile and laugh a little bit. Because this was so far beyond.
Yeah, they have no idea, right?
It's so far beyond,
yes,
that when I hear it, I think, you know, as soon as you give a name to something, you negate it. So when you say unconditional love, you're really negating what that type of love really feels like, you know?
Yes.
And I just felt I belonged where I was. I didn't belong any place else. That's where I was. And he was there, and I was there, and this presence was there, and I knew that he was alive and he was well, and that things were exactly the way they were supposed to be. Eventually, the smile on his face changed into this. It wasn't sad. It was the most peaceful, joyful expression that you could have, but there wasn't a smile. I know that doesn't make sense. I don't know how else to say it.
No,
I knew that meant goodbye. I knew it meant goodbye, and I also
knew.
For a little while. Yeah, and I knew I wasn't going to be able to go with him because I had no place where he was going. I didn't belong there. I was in the place where I was supposed to be.
Yes.
And eventually he disappeared from my sight, and I say sight, once again, I'm using physical terms, and this really wasn't a physical thing. It was, but it wasn't. Once again, this is, you know, it's still difficult to explain. And I just closed my eyes, and eventually I felt myself just being back in this dingy, miserable, dark little hospital room. And I looked like crazy to find that point of light where I could get back to where I was, but I was never able to find it again. It just wasn't speaking to me anymore, and I wasn't going to be allowed to go back to where I had been taken.
Everyone, that is what a spiritually transformative experience feels like. What it does is to transform everything, and it's a permanent transformation.
Absolutely.
It's a permanent transformation. So yes. Now Sharon is spending her life helping other people who are in the midst of crises like the crisis that she was in after she lost her daughter when her husband was so sick, which is exactly, I think, what it was meant to do for you. It was meant to heal you spiritually so you could give to others. Don't you think that's true?
That's exactly why I do what I do. But it's really funny, and I tell people this, and they kind of laugh at me, but the people that I work with and my friends know it's absolutely true. After this experience, every single thing in my life and in my family's life and in my community's life, because everyone knew what had happened, and everything changed. My belief system totally changed. Everything I thought I knew, I didn't know. I had walked my entire life with the pictures and the ideas that are given to you, you know, from the pulpit someplace, and they totally missed the point.
Yes, it changed, absolutely.
Changed every single thing, and that's when I decided I'm going to get back to where I was. So I decided, you know what? Probably the easiest way to do that is to continue on. I was going to be a psychiatrist in the beginning, and I decided, no, I wasn't going to be the pill popper. And so I thought, okay, psychology, that's it. And I'm going to have as my patient population, I'm going to have terminally ill, because maybe I can hitch a ride back to the stars.
Yes, isn't that beautiful?
You know?
That is exactly...
But it never worked. It never worked. But it was selfish on my part in the beginning, because
well,
I was thinking I'm going to be a hitchhiker.
But it
became something very different.
Many people have these experiences at bedsides. We don't yet know how many there are. We're probably 15 years away from where NDEs mm-hmm. are right now in terms of being studied, but these will be studied. And the website is shareddeathstudy.org. I'll also put it in the description of this episode. They just collect these stories. So if you want to be part of what's going on, and if you've had any kind of experience like this, or you know someone who has, you can help people to do this these studies, and then to share with us what actually is going on. But that's just beautiful. And the thing is, she writes so well that it was really, you sort of went through it with her, which was really wonderful. Sharon, you have a website, right? Sharon, SharonPrentice.com is
right,
Sharon's
yes.
website. And if people want to get in touch with you, is there a way they can do that?
Well, you know, they can email me at drsharonprentice@gmail.com, or they can go to what they call my professional Facebook page. Doesn't that sound silly? But I have two. One is personal, that, you know, for my family, because we're all over the place. And then the other one is just Sharon Prentice, PhD. We've got like 35,000 people on there now, which is very scary, because when you think that many people are listening to you, it's like, oh, no, that's not cool. I respond to everyone. I have no one else responding for me. I do it myself. And then, you know, Instagram and what's that other one? Twitter.
You do Twitter, too.
People... Yeah, but I don't do Twitter that much. I basically do everything on Facebook, and then it just automatically goes over to Twitter because I'm normally with people. I'm a talker. I'm not a, you know, I don't do all too much of that social media stuff just to be doing it. I do it if people, you know, want information or have a problem that, you know, they want to discuss a little bit. So that's when I'm on.
If you have a loved one who's dying, or if you're dying yourself, there is a lot of help. Like Sharon, and there are others as well, people who can help you to do well with your death, with your dying. I mean, I'm happy. You can reach out to me. I'm happy to help you know that, hey, the fun part's just about to start. Remember, my first book in this series is called The Fun of Dying, and it understates the case. So, and certainly that beautiful story of how this handsome young man, he died at 33. Can you believe it? But he ended up... He was once again that handsome young man. I mean, this is – life is a comedy. It's not a tragedy. And it's beautiful stories, frankly, like yours, Sharon, that helps people to know that. I'm so glad you've been with us. Believe it or not, we've come to the end of our time. But please consider yourself hugged and let me know how you're doing. I think your story is just wonderful.
I will. Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed being with you, especially, you know – taking that walk down memory lane. Not many people understand, you know, what we remember,
you
know.
You had to be in the 60s. No one could possibly understand it otherwise.
You did. This is great. I love it.
This has been Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes, and I'm so glad you could be with us today. Please never forget that you are a powerful, eternal being. You never began, you never will end, and when you really understand what that means, it will change everything in your life for the better. Our guests next week will be Vincent James and Joanne Pierdomenico, and they've been here before. They're our very own Seek Reality husband and wife experts in the field of music and its extraordinary emotional power. They asked if they could come in sometime in February just to talk about Teach Music Week, which is upcoming in March. And I asked them also to help us begin to talk more deeply about the amazing spiritual power that music has in our lives. So I have to admit, I have a very soft spot in my heart for anybody who has an intense passion for anything positive. And these two have made sharing their love for music their entire obsession, especially with children. Now, I'm not musical, and if you aren't musical either, that's fine. I think you're going to enjoy these beautiful guests, so please join us next week. This week, we've been talking with Dr. Sharon Prentice, which, frankly, I really enjoyed this because, as she said, very few people really get what it's like to have been there in the 60s. Sharon's shared death experience when her husband died profoundly affected her. She talks about all of that beautifully in her book, and it has transformed her life, becoming Starlight, but boasts a foreword by Dr. Raymond Moody. And Dr. Moody, frankly, is a delight in our field. He coined both near-death experiences and shared death experiences as terms. But near-death experiences don't happen in the afterlife. But shared death experiences are an amazing glimpse behind the curtain as an actual death is happening. I consider them to be evidential for that reason. And I really enjoyed becoming Starlight. And I love the way Dr. Prentice has triumphed over having lost her beloved husband when he was only 33. As you know, my own nonfiction books are Liberating Jesus, My Thomas, The Fun of Dying, The Fun of Staying in Touch, The Fun of Growing Forever, The Fun of Living Together, and very soon, The Fun of Loving Jesus, Embracing the Christianity that Jesus Taught. For young children, there's also The Fun of Meeting Jesus, which is a beautiful picture book. You can order all these books through bookstores or on Amazon.com. And, of course, the adult books are also available as audiobooks. If you want to talk about any of my books, if you want to just talk about anything at all, you can always contact me through robertagrimes.com. I do answer, like Dr. Prentice, I answer every email. Just please be sure to give me your correct email address. It can take up to a week. I try not to make it take that long because I get so many some days, but I do answer every email, and I'm always, always honored when people reach out that way and people let me help them in whatever's going on in their lives. Past episodes of Seek Reality are available on webtalkradio.net, Real Revolution Radio, iTunes, iHeartRadio, and a bunch of other stations, including those in the wonderful Dream Vision 7 radio family. And through the Seek Reality app, you can find for free in the iTunes App Store. And if you ever wonder where I am right now, you can always just go to robertagrimes.com and click on the radio tab. And if you enjoy these weekly conversations, you might want to check out my blog at robertagrimes.com. I use it to work through some of the issues we talk about here on Seek Reality. And I'm amazed to say some people will email me and tell me that they wait for my new post each week. One woman wrote and said she keeps hitting refresh because they're sent out at 4:02 in the morning on Sunday mornings. And she lived on the other side of the world. But I thought, you know, that's a little much. I don't think I would sit there and hit send. But if you're interested in learning more about some of the things we talk about, you may enjoy my blog. What I'm trying to do is just to ease your path. I'm trying to help you get to the truth in just a few years' time rather than in the 5 decades this journey has taken me. And I want most of all to help you arrive at the certainty that you are a powerful, indestructible, eternal, and perfectly loved being. You are a part of the only God. I want to help you grow spiritually into the infinitely powerful divine being that, frankly, you already are. eternally. You just forgot. I'm trying to help you remember. Being free from fear and living in perfection is the happiest you ever can be. Meanwhile, this has been Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. Please enjoy and make the most of this coming week in our one reality, knowing that you are a powerful, eternal being, and you in particular are infinitely loved.
You've been listening to Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. Roberta blogs and answers questions at robertagrimes.com. Join us every week as we explore what the afterlife evidence and modern science combine to tell us is true about the one reality we all share. Knowing the truth changes everything.